We are now going to turn to a political cultural commentary from within a prison by Mumia Abu-Jamal, political activist and commentator who has been imprisoned wrongfully for almost 40 years. He records his commentaries with the help of Noel Hanrahan of Prison News. The one I'd like to share today is titled Star Wars and the American Imagination. It also appears as a contribution in the science fiction anthology Octavius Brood, Science Fiction Stories from Social Movements, that itself is co-edited by Walida Imarisha and Adrian Marie Brown. Walida joins me after Mumia's reading to talk about the piece, to talk about Octavius Brood, May the 4th, Star Wars, and the politics of science fiction.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 0.
When Star Wars premiered in 1977, it swept the nation like a fever. Lines circled blocks, and before long, it was more than a movie. It was a craze. TV commercials hawked wares emblazoned with Star Wars figures available from McDonald's. Get yours now. Before all was said and done, the movie grossed nearly $500 million. That's billions, with a B. I was, however, out of the loop. In 1977, I was in my 23rd year of life, and the targeted demographic was pre-teen and teen rather than post-teen. Besides, I was more of a Star Trek guy, and it didn't hurt that one of the stars of the Trekkie universe was a black beauty who blazed the screen like a dark, luscious comet every time she appeared. To the uninitiated, I here refer to actress Nichelle Nichols, who performed as Lieutenant Uhura of the Trek bridge crew. That said, I watched with fascination as the lines grew and other film companies tried to copy the money-making magic of the Star Wars franchise. They usually failed miserably, however. Why did Star Wars strike such a deep and jangling nerve? Why did it become a craze? One would seem to surprise everyone, critics, the movie's executives, all it seemed, except producer George Lucas. The nation had just recently been forced to submit to a seemingly uncivilized as in low-tech enemy, and it faced the generational rebellion of the 60s. The Vietnam syndrome permeated the culture, not just the political elites. The younger were virtually uniformly anti-war in their orientation, and a counterculture was sweeping the nation, changing dress, hairstyles, sexual mores, food consumption, and the way national minorities both were perceived and perceived themselves. In short, the land was in the midst of a cultural and political rebellion sparked, in large part, by resistance to an unpopular war. An American president, Nixon, recently resigned several months after his vice president, top aides, including the Attorney General, John Mitchell, were sent to prison, the human detritus of what would become the Watergate scandal. In this context, why would a movie, even one set in another world, find appeal when the heroes were the ragtag bunch of rebels, decidedly low-tech, fighting against a fearsome, militarily invincible empire? Part of Star Wars' success was its undeniable youth appeal, yet there must be deeper reasons for its cultural resonance. America, the Empire, didn't like its role, at least among the young. It wanted to reimagine itself as the ragtag band, fighting against great odds, against an evil empire. It imagined itself as it wanted to be, as it claimed to be in its infancy, against a cruel and despotic king of the late 18th century. It reshaped itself into the rebels, not the imperial overlords. It shaped itself as oppressed, fighting for freedom. But America, like every nation, has its ages of psychosis. It has fits of indecision and periods of self-delusion. Consider how American presidents spoke movingly of freedom from tyranny while holding personally hundreds of men, women, and children in slavery. Or imagine Jefferson, the sage of Monticello, who was the father of half black children, at the same moment as he wrote in his only book, Notes on the State of Virginia, that black people were essentially non-human, a species related to the orangutan. I mean, does this mean that he saw himself as being into bestiality? Or did this mean he really thought his children were, well, half monkey? Americans, like any people, are subject to delusions. Was this fascination with Star Wars and the national identification with the rebels one of them? For generations, Americans have declined to define themselves as imperialists. That's what our enemies called us. That wasn't what we called ourselves. We were for freedom. We were for self-determination. We were good. We were white, mostly. We were Luke Skywalker, not Darth Vader, and definitely not the cruel, warped Emperor. Yet aficionados of the Star Wars saga know that Luke and Darth were, after all, intimately related. Darth's infamous line at their lightsaber battle has become a cultural byword, "I am your father, Luke." It is a measure of Lucas's genius that he scripts that moment of self-realization, of self-discovery, and of revelation. In the grisly aftermath of a war that tore millions from the face of Asia, all to cover for the corporate exploitation of Vietnam's bauxite and other natural resources, the Imperial shock trooper, the Imperial metallic death hand, was father to the rebel. They were, in fact, more than related. In truth, they were one. That is the meaning of Star Wars. We were rebels. We are Empire. And like all rebellious children, we were but going through a phase. We're getting ready for adulthood after we sowed a few wild oats. Once grown, we put on our Imperial uniform and bow to the Empire. It is your destiny, right? Unless... From somewhere, maybe on the Enterprise, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal reading Star Wars and the American Imagination, which appears as a contribution in the science fiction anthology Octavia's Brood, Science Fiction Stories from Social Justice Movements. I'm now joined over the phone by Walida Imarisha, a co-editor of that volume, to talk about it. She is an editor, an educator, a writer, a public scholar, and spoken word artist. She edited two anthologies, including Octavia's Brood and Another World is Possible. She's taught at Stanford University's Rhetoric Program, PNCA, in Portland State University's Black Studies Department, and Oregon State University's Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies Department. For 6 years, she presented statewide as a public scholar with Oregon Humanities Conversation Project on topics such as Oregon Black History, Alternatives to Incarceration, and the History of Hip Hop. Thank you so much, Walida, for coming on The Old Mole today to nerd out about May the 4th.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
The segment we heard before this one was a reading by Mumia Abu-Jamal of an essay that's a contribution in Octavia's Brood. Could you put it in the context of Octavia's Brood and how it touches on both classic sci-fi and innovative or visionary science fiction?
Well, Octavia's Brood, Science Fiction Stories from Social Justice Movements, is an anthology I co-edited with Adrienne Marie Brown, and it is fantastical writing by artists, activists, organizers, and change makers. And so a lot of the folks we reached out to may not have written science fiction before, but we knew that they would create amazing visionary stories because the premise of Octavia's Brood is all organizing is science fiction. So every time we imagine a world without borders, without war, without prisons, that's science fiction because we haven't seen that world. But we absolutely need imaginative spaces like science fiction that allow us to throw out everything we've been told is possible and start with the question, what is the world we want, rather than the question, what is a reasonable win? And so Mumia's contribution to the collection is incredibly special and powerful and amazing, as we just heard. And I think it does part of what we hoped Octavia's Brood would do, which is sort of a two-part engagement of engaging with existing science fiction franchises and fandoms like Star Wars and allowing us to really explore the politics in it and say, how can this be relevant and useful for our movements for justice? And then Octavia's Brood also wants to create spaces for us to come together collectively to imagine new worlds from the bottom up rather than engaging with someone else's vision of the future. So we're hoping to do both.
A number of the stories and pieces in Octavius Brood touch on crises and dystopia. Which ones do you think speak most to our moment right now?
There are so many, and I think it's really important to immerse ourselves in what I call visionary fiction, which is fantastical art that helps us to imagine how to build new just worlds. It's important to recognize that's not utopian, because oftentimes the reality of the work that we need to do to build the liberated futures we want, it's going to be hard. It's going to involve sometimes things getting worse, sometimes much worse, as we're seeing in this current crisis. But it's important to recognize that we can always make it better, and we can always build the world we want as we're engaging in collective action and collective struggle and rooting in the principles and values that we have. And so, you know, there are a number of stories in Octavius Brood that deal with things getting worse, from Children Who Fly, which is by Leah Lakshmi Pyapsnasamarasinha, which takes place in the flooded remains of San Francisco and the Bay Area, and imagines a ecological crisis that has really devastated the world. And yet it is the children of folks who are engaged in organizing work today, who are coming together and through their own experiences as survivors of trauma and abuse are able to come together and heal the entire world. And it's stories like that that I think highlight how important imagination is and how important a space for emotion is. Because an understanding that those of us who have been victimized, we are not broken, we actually then have the powers to heal the world, it fundamentally changes how we think about our organizing work today. And so I think that's one of the many gifts of visionary fiction or radical science fiction.
That emotionally inclusive and intelligent way of writing science fiction is a feature of Octavia Butler's work itself. Could you speak to how she became the namesake of this volume and how she is the mother of this brood?
Yeah, Octavia's Brood is named in honor of Octavia E. Butler. The title is a play on Octavia's trilogy called Lilith's Brood. And for us, we really think of ourselves, hopefully, in lineage with Octavia. We are sure that we're probably doing things differently than how she would do it, but we hope that she sees the DNA of her writing, of her visioning, of her important social critique that came through her science fiction work in the work that we're doing. And for many of us, that is the first place that we sort of saw an intersection between, a clear intersection between organizing and science fiction, and really saw what it means to center folks of color, women of color, women of color with disabilities, queer women of color with disabilities, all of those different identities, and what it means to have a different relationship with power, what it means to talk about collectively sharing power rather than building hierarchy. And so I think Octavia E. Butler's lessons are so prescient and so important for us today. She is one of the many voices that is key to being able to imagine things differently than they are.
We'll have to have you back on to do a focus on Octavia or one of her works. Before we go, I'd like to zoom back out to the theme of the day, May the 4th and Star Wars, and ask you to engage a bit more with Mumia's piece and how you identify as a Star Wars fan.
Sure. The essay that Mumia read began when I wrote to Mumia and told him we were creating Octavia's Brood, and he just wrote back this beautiful, almost fully formed piece about the power of science fiction, specifically through Star Wars, and I wrote back and said, can we print this? Because I think it's so important to reflect on these franchises and fandoms that have shaped all of us, and to think about what is the political messaging that was intended, what is the political messaging each of us got out of it, and what is the political messaging that has been put upon it. And all of those can be the same or very different. And so Mumia's exploration of the concept of empire and the idea of rebellion is always important, but especially in these times, to say, what does it mean if we want to be part of the rebel forces? And I have yet to meet anyone who wants to be part of the empire. If you meet someone who wants to be part of the empire, you should get away from them. But what does it mean to be part of the rebel forces on the ground in this day and age? It means standing against empire, and it means collectively organizing and mobilizing on the ground with the leadership of those who are most affected. And so how do we reimagine our work in that light?
It's such a quintessential American fantasy, isn't it? You go back to the origins of this country, which are shrouded in revolutionary rhetoric against the empire, and you fast forward to today, and you have armed so-called protesters of the lockdown situation rebelling against public health measures for the sake of the economy. There are so many contradictory things bound up in this signifier of the rebel.
It's incredibly important to ask the question, what is being rebelled against? And also, what is being fought for? That question is incredibly important for our movement. That, as a Star Wars fan, has been interesting to see with the finalization of this last trilogy, to really see that in Star Wars, we are fighting against the Empire, and that's very clear, and that's important. But we don't often get a vision of what we are fighting for. And I think that that is part of why it is something that draws in a larger American public. Because I think if we extend that out and say, if we're against an evil empire, what are we for? Well, then we're for communal, collective, mutual aid societies that, you know, are cooperative and make sure everyone's basic needs are met. Then folks have to ask themselves uncomfortable questions about what that actually means on the ground and their own feelings toward that. In some ways, I appreciate Star Wars because I appreciate an unquestioning anti-fascist commitment, which I think to me is what I take away from Star Wars, that there can never be any compromise with empire and with fascism, that it must be fought at every level. But I think the thing that we have to be building, and this is why we need our own imaginative spaces, we have to be offering visions of what we want, not just fighting against what we don't want.
Such a good note to end on. Thank you, Walida Imarisha, for coming on The Old Mole today to talk about Star Wars and the politics of science fiction.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and thanks for letting me nerd out.